So Jamie was asking about the cake. It was great. My son Joshua helped bake a cake. So I was wondering if there's anyone that wants a piece of cake. Come on up here, Faith. Come on up here. Come on up here. Josh, come on up. Emily, yeah, come on up. Yeah, come on up here. Yeah, you want some cake? This is going to be great. You like cake? Here we go. I'm gonna, here, give that to Paul. All right. Oh, there we go. Yes, yes. You guys want some cake. Oh, we love cake. What was that? Yeah, why would Josh want cake? That just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. All right. Here, hold on. Don't judge. It's cake. There we go. Come on. There. Josh, what happened with the cake? Did you follow the instructions? Kinda. What were the ingredients? What did you have to put in?
Eggs, vegetable oil, and water.
Okay, so did you put them in the cake? Kinda. Well, what did you put in? You forgot the eggs. Did you measure it? Did you measure the ingredients? Did you just do one of these things like, oh, that looks good enough? Yeah. And it's a little bit cooked on the edges. Did you bake it long enough? How long was this supposed to bake for? 30 minutes. How long did you bake this for? You don't know? Did you just pull it out too early or what? Oh my gosh. You guys can go back to, you don't want this, do you? I can. You guys can go sit down. Yeah, all right. This is a good lesson, actually. If you do not follow the instructions, if you only partially, I'm just putting it in front of you, you're fine. If you only partially follow the instructions, you end up with mush, a mess. Right? In that kind of life, right? Everything else in life is kind of that way. What if you only partially followed the law while you were driving? All right? Yeah, what if you were only partially drunk when you were driving? What if you only partially filled out that job application? Round five. What if you only partially did your test? What if I only partially wrote this sermon? We leave early. The excitement grows. If you only partially follow the instructions, it leads to disastrous results, right? That's life. That's also spiritual life. That's also godly life. If we only partially follow God's instructions, we end up with a huge mess. That's the story of the book of Judges in one fell swoop. The book of Judges is the story of how the Israelite nation only partially followed God's instructions, and what ended up was a big, huge, gigantic mess. Ever since the Israelite nation was freed from Egypt, when they went and finally were set free to go and worship God, and God started saying, I have a plan for you. I'm going to take you into a land. And it's a great land, flowing with milk and honey. There's lots of land. The problem is there's people in the land, and you need to go into the land. You need to remove those people, and then you can have the land. And he said over and over and over again, when you get there, don't partially do it. You've got to get rid of all of them. They've all got to go. And some people say that sounds a little harsh. That sounds like maybe God hates certain cultures. This was not about God hating anything. It was his intense love for the Israelite nation that said, I know that if you have all these other people around you, eventually you're going to do what they do. And what they did was terrible. If you ever want to read it, Leviticus 18 and Deuteronomy 18 are laws that God set forth for the Israelite nation in direct contrast to the people living in the land. You'll read through Leviticus 18, and essentially every line of that starts with, do not have sexual relations with, and then it goes through the list. Mom, dad, a mother and her daughter, the cow. It goes through this, and we read it and we're like, oh, that's really bad. That is what was happening in the land, and it had been happening for hundreds of years. So God said, I can't have you go in there because what's going to happen is if you don't remove them, they will start having influence over you. And so all through the book of Exodus, all through Leviticus, all through Numbers, all through Deuteronomy, over and over and over again, like a parent instructing their child, make sure you do this right. It's God advertising, saying this is the most important thing when you get into the land. The most important thing is you've got to get these people out. They've got to go. So you would think that when they entered into the land, that they would just simply follow God's instructions. They learned quickly that when you partially follow God's instructions, it leads to disastrous results. The book of Joshua is them going into the land under the leadership of a guy named Joshua. And what they did was they conquered the land kind of in a big way. Like they came in and displaced large groups of people. And you can read all about the conquest they have. And it's really kind of fascinating to read how they subdued the land. But what happened was as they would enter the land, they would take most of it over. And then it would be up to the individual tribes to finish the work. So they would go into an area and they say, okay, we've pretty much conquered this area, but you can't conquer everything in just a short amount of time. So tribe of Zebulun, we've got most of it done. You're going to have to get rid of the rest of them. And it was left up to every individual tribe to finish the work, to fully follow God's instructions. And the book of Judges says that they didn't do it. In fact, chapter 1 of the book of Judges is really an introduction. Almost everyone seems to agree that this introduction is not original to the person who wrote the book of Judges, but it got attached to it and is now part of God's word because it really does a great intro to what the book of Judges is all about. It's going to start, I'm telling you right now, it's going to start off good and then it's going to end bad, which is the story of Judges. We're going to start off at the beginning. And I didn't really know this. I've learned so much already in the book of Judges. It starts off with almost the ideal judge, which we're going to get introduced here in chapter 1. His name was Othniel. And then as time goes on, the judges kind of keep getting worse and worse and worse until everyone agrees the worst judge shows up on the scene, that long-haired dude, Samson. He was really strong until he got a haircut. Samson, you know, we often make him an idol, but he's not. If you read some of the stuff he did, like we're going to get to it, and you're like, he did what? He loved to frequent places that had women of the night regularly. Like it's actually going to say it. So this is how the chapter 1 goes. It starts off with things going good, and then it goes bad. But the whole theme throughout chapter 1 is partially following God's instructions leads to disasters, but the equally important truth is if you fully follow God's instructions, you can have fantastic results. It's just a truism. It's truth. That's what we're going to see. Chapter 1. Let's get into this stuff. When you look at it, you're like, we're going to do all of chapter 1. Yeah, it's 36 verses. I'm going to summarize a couple of places. So we're not going to go through every single line, but we really got to catch what's going on here. Verse 1. After the death of Joshua, which is a huge deal. Up until then, they had Moses, who was leading the group and was spectacular, and everyone said, there is no way we can replace Moses. Joshua came along and led spectacularly. He was incredible. So after Joshua is finished with his stuff, the big question is, who's in charge now? That's what they ask. After the death of Joshua, the Israelites asked the Lord, who will be the first to go up and fight for us against the Canaanites? What they really want to know is, who's in charge? Right? Don't you hate going into a situation you don't know who's in charge? Because then everyone's in charge or no one's in charge, and it becomes a mess. So they start off by asking, which of course, we're going to come back to this stuff because we learned stuff in this first section, which is fantastic. I'll come back to it. Verse 2, the Lord answered, Judah is to go. I have given the land into their hands. So Judah was the southern tribe, one of the largest tribes, and it was also one of the most powerful tribes. And so God said, they're going to be the ones that are going to lead the way. As you continue going into this land, Judah is going to kind of provide the template for it. So the men of Judah said to the Simeonites, that's another tribe, Judah completely and utterly enveloped the tribe of Simeon geographically. So if you have pictures of the tribes, I should have put one up there. You will see that the southern kingdom says Judah, and then there's this little circle, and in it says Simeon. So Judah says to Simeon, come up with us into the territory allotted to us to fight against the Canaanites. We, in turn, will go with you into yours. So the Simeonites went with them. This is good stuff. I'm coming back to it because this is, I like to end on the positive stuff, so we're going to pick up these lessons in a little bit. So when Judah attacked, the Lord gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hands, and they struck down 10,000 men at Bezek. So if you fully follow God's instructions, it leads to fantastic results. This is the truth that we're learning. God said, go in, take them all out, push them all out, have the land, you'll have success. They did it, and it worked. It's pretty simple. Follow God's commands, things go well for you. Verse 5, it was there that they fought Adonai Bezek and fought against him, putting to rout the Canaanites and Perizzites. Adonai Bezek fled, but they chased him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes. Why did they cut off his thumb and big toe? Well, have you ever tried to walk without your big toe? Yes. It's a little bit difficult, isn't it? What was that? A quarter of the way there. Yeah. Your big toe, also your pinky toe, is used for huge balance issues. Yeah. If you don't have them, you're like, what? Really? My pinky toe helps me balance? Yes, it does. And then what happens if your thumb's cut off? Yeah, you can't be the Fonz, right? You can't do Facebook, right? Like, right? Can't get a ride, yeah? And then, of course, I really wanted to do this, but I knew it would take too long. You know, for fun, just take some tape and tape up your thumb and then, like, do stuff. You still pick your nose, right? That's still, you're good with that. You still point at people. But have you ever tried to pick something up without your opposable thumb? It's a little hard, ain't it? And brush your teeth without your thumbs. No way. You're like, I got to pick it. Yeah. Tape it, put it on Facebook, and then tag me and Searchlight Ministries in it. We'll see just how good you do without your opposable. What would happen is, could you carry a sword? No. You are now incapacitated. Adonai Bezek is destroyed. When you fully follow God's instructions, even these kings that were very powerful would fall. How powerful was Adonai Bezek? Oh, he was very powerful. Verse 7, then Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off have picked up scraps under my table. Now God has paid me back for what I did to them. They brought him to Jerusalem and he died there. He essentially said, look, I've been in this war game for a while. I've taken out 70 nations. And every time we subdued a nation, I took their king and I cut off their thumb and their big toe. And now God is paying me back for what I'm doing. Isn't it interesting when a pagan king actually has better theology than the people of Israel? And that it's kind of rough when that happens. But Adonai Bezek is a powerful king, so powerful that he was able to take over 70 nations. And now God says, look, you just follow my instructions. And when you fully follow me, I will make sure that everything works out good for you. I will go in before you. I will take out kings. I will take out places. This is really important. Think about it again for your own life. When you fully follow God's instructions, does it work well for you in your life? Well, let's take a couple of examples. What if you were someone who was really honest in life? Would that work ultimately in your benefit in the grand scheme of your life if you were just constantly honest? Maybe you're at work and someone makes an accusation that you are a liar, and everyone around you says, that cannot be true, because this person never, ever lies. Their life is characterized by honesty. They so fully follow God's instructions that it simply works well for them. What happens in terms of loving the people around you? What about treating others the way you want to be treated? If you treated other people the way you wanted to be treated, would that go well with you in your life in the grand scheme of things? Right? Parents, do you want your kids to respect you? What if you treated your kids the same way you wanted to be treated? Would that change things? Kids, do you want your parents to be kind to you? The answer is yes. Then don't be a brat and speak nicely to them. Do you see how this works? I mean, it's think about it. What about your boss? If you, does your boss want respect and to be treated kindly? Yeah. And if you have that, if you are an employee that treats your boss with respect, will that eventually benefit you? If you fully follow God's commands, eventually it's going to help you out, right? These are incredible things that help us out to understand. How about treating your teachers, kids? How do you think your teachers want to be treated? With respect. I know some of them are not worthy of respect, right, Anthony? I know. I can see his wheels turning. He's like, not my teachers. They're all bad and nasty and ugly. What would happen if you actually treated your teacher with respect? Would that ultimately benefit you? Yeah, this is what happens when you fully follow God's instructions. You're going to end up with fantastic results. You can take any law, anything that God commands, and say, if I fully follow this, what's going to happen in the grand scheme of my life? And you'll find out some great things happen. Is it just in the big things, or does God also help out in the little details of your life? It's in both. If you actually fully follow God's instructions, great things also happen interpersonally. This is what happens a little bit later on. Let's keep going. Verse 8. The men of Judah attacked Jerusalem also and took it. They put the city to the sword and set it on fire. I know, it sounds harsh, doesn't it? Again, read Leviticus 18 and Deuteronomy 18, and you will find that this is like the embodiment of evil. And you'll be like, ooh, right? This is one where you would not want a surgeon to go into your body and say, cancer is a living thing too. I think I'll only partially remove it because I don't want to destroy it all. You're like, no, get it all out, because if you leave it unchecked, what does cancer eventually do? It spreads, it grows, and it ultimately kills you. This is the analogy that I find the best when I think about these people. God was saying they are going to infiltrate and they are going to eventually poison you to the point where you are going to not want to be a follower of Yahweh anymore. Now, at the end of the day, what is the most important thing for God? God's number one concern has always been your eternal destination, period. That's why he uses any and every means to get your attention and keep your attention. That means if you are going down the wrong path, bad things are going to happen, because the number one thing is God wants you, period. So if his children are going to end up being put in a situation that is ultimately going to destroy them, he's going to say, no, you get rid of them first. You get them out of there. This is what is most important. And so they did. They were fighting and they were putting cities to the sword. They were setting. They were getting rid of everything. Verse 9, after that, the men of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites living in the hill country, the Negev and the western foothills. They advanced against the Canaanites living in Hebron, formerly called Kiriath Arba, and defeated Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. All of these people are falling because they're fully following God's instructions. And in the grand scheme of life, things are beneficial for the people. It's good stuff. But then also this personal thing is really cool. From there, they advanced against the people living in Debir, formerly called Kiriath Sefer, And Caleb, do y'all remember Caleb? Who's Caleb? He was one of the 12 men that went to spy on Canaan. 10 were bad and 2 were good. Yeah, 40 years earlier before they entered into the promised land. And Caleb was one with Joshua who said, I think we could take these guys. And Joshua and Caleb says, we can win in the promised land, not because we're strong. We can win because we got God with us. If we got God with us, no one can really stop us. So Caleb is one of these, you know, he was a young guy at the time. And now he's kind of this de facto leader. He's doing some great things. So Caleb, he says, I will give my daughter Aksa in marriage to the man who attacks and captures Kiriath Sefer. Isn't that a great motivation? Can you do that? That would be awesome with faith. Like, he who captures tickets to the Super Bowl for me shall have my daughter in marriage. Yeah, it doesn't really work in today's society, does it? But back then, and it's really bad. There's some other people that offer really bad things. Like, I wrote it down. Where is it? If you want to read, it's in 1 Samuel 18:25. Someone had to get 100 Philistine foreskins and they could have the daughter in marriage. How do you get those? No. You just read it and you're like, that's really bizarre. But anyway, so this was a typical thing. You know, we see that in other things, you know, someone who attacks. So Caleb's like, I got this daughter. She's great. If someone attacks this place, you can have her hand in marriage. And so we get introduced to the first dude, Othniel. He is the first judge. We learn more about him in chapter 3. Chapter 2 is another introduction from God's point of view as he sees the cycle of sin of the Israelite nation. So we get kind of two intros before we get into the actual judges. But we get introduced to Othniel. Othniel's like, I'll do it. Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it. So Caleb gave his daughter Aksa to him in marriage. Younger brother could also be cousin, just to let you know. I know it's a little weird, like, ew, I don't want to marry my uncle. Yeah, that's a little creepy. I totally get that. But again, when they use these phrases, it often doesn't mean actual younger brother. So Caleb says, I'll do it. And so he did it. And I love it because all it says is Caleb's younger brother took it. Is that easy? An entire city falls using three words. Why? Because they were fully following God's instructions. He said, take this place. I'll be with you. They're like, okay, sounds good. I'll take this place. They took this place. And it not only helped them in the grand scheme of things, but also there's this odd little story right in the middle of it of a marriage. And that's why it almost seems out of place, but I think it's intentionally put in there so that we don't just think that God helps us out globally, so to speak, but he's interested in you and your life. Look at what it, then there's the story goes on with this these two people, Caleb and Aksa. Verse 14, one day when she came to Othniel, right, came to Pop, say, Dad, I want a field. Urgent. One day she came to Othniel, her husband. She urged him to ask her father for a field. So she is looking out for the best interests of her husband. As we read through Aksa, she actually becomes the ideal judge's wife, I guess you could say. Because she is always in favor of her husband. She is always working for her husband. She is always doing stuff for the benefit of their family, which is going to be in direct contrast to the last judge, Samson, and who is the worst judge, and also the worst judge's wife, Delilah, who is only trying to get Samson's information for money. She doesn't care about Samson. She doesn't care about Yahweh. All she cares about is money, and she often acts in self-centered ways. This is a huge contrast. I think that's the other reason why Aksa is mentioned. She is kind of, ideally, she's saying, hey, I think something is important here. Let's go ask, you go ask my dad for a field. It doesn't say it, but the inference is he did, and they got the field. It was quite simple, actually. Right? Isn't that what we do? Go ask Dad. He's a softie. And so he was. But then, I'm in the middle of verse 14. It's really weird Hebrew construction. When she got off her donkey, which is, something else is going on there. The verbs are semi-violent. The inference is, most people think, is what happens is she fell off the donkey. So she's riding to dad, right? She's on the donkey, and then she gets there, and she's like, whoa! Right, because she gets off her donkey. Why would that garner any attention? There's also some other weird theories, but that's the one I'm drawn to. I think it's right. She slips off her donkey, and what does he think dad's going to do? Oh, my precious pumpkin, what happened? Are you okay? And that's exactly what happens. Caleb asked her, what can I do for you, honey? Are you okay? And what does she do? Oh, women. Do me, I'm just saying, you are crafty. Do me a special favor, since you have given me land in the Negev, give me also springs of water. Then Caleb gave her the upper and lower springs. He's like, well, thanks for the field. We're out in the desert. Can I have some water with that? And Caleb's like, oh, sure thing, pumpkin. Oh, hello. But the idea is, these people are all following God's instructions, and they're getting blessed because of it. If you fully follow God's instructions, then fantastic results tend to happen. That's just kind of a truism in life. Now, think about it personally, going back to the examples. What would happen if you chose not to lie to the people that are closest to you? Would that improve the relationship? I would think so. You would ultimately build up a spirit of trust so that all you have to do is say something to your spouse or to your kids, and they are going to ultimately believe you. You lie to them, and they ultimately don't believe you. I know this full well when I took Jacob on the Tower of Terror at California's Disneyland Adventure, right? We get there, and he's like, what's this ride, Daddy? I go, it's a fun ride, son. This is a great little, you need to come and try. He's like, Daddy, is it a scary ride? How old were you? I can't even remember. You were five? I know. Joshua loved it. Not saying anything. But anyway, so I'm saying, Jacob, come on, let's go on. So we go on, and after the ride is over, he has this look in his eye like I think he just slipped into a coma, and he's going to go into the corner, and he's going to rock back and forth, and out of nowhere, he just bursts into tears. And after that, I'd be like, hey, Jacob, let's ride, Winnie the Pooh's Grand Adventure. He's like, it's probably scary. Right? He doesn't trust us that much more because we lied to him. What happens if we actually didn't do that? What if we never lied to the people that are closest to us? What if we treated the people closest to us the same way they want to be treated? Would that change your interpersonal relationships? Fully following God's instructions tends to give you fantastic results. Period. Plain. It's simple. So it's in the big things of life, jobs, schools, careers, small things of life as well, your interpersonal relationships. I just wanted him to go on the ride. But there was another thing too. You do that as an adult, right? You're driving somewhere, and I think we were driving to Disneyland, and they're acting up in the back, and what do you say? Knock it off, or we're going to turn around and go home. And I leaned over to Heather. I go, are we really prepared to do that? Like, I kind of want to go to Disneyland. Like, what do we do if they actually act up? Are we actually going home? She's like, yes, we are. I'm like, okay, dear. Yeah, right? This is totally true. It's tough. We sometimes lie to our kids to get our results, but what happens is eventually our kids stop trusting us. What if we didn't lie to them? I'm telling you, you fully follow God's instruction, good things happen, generally speaking, in the big things and the small things. So I love this little story, this little marriage story. Here they are conquering grand cities, and then there's these two people getting married. Some people say, who cares about Caleb and Aksa and their field and springs of living water? I'll tell you two people who cared. Caleb and Aksa. Their life was good because they fully followed God's instruction. As I said, it starts good, and then goes downhill. Verse 16. The descendants of Moses' father-in-law, the Kenite, went up from the city of Palms with the men of Judah to live among the people of the desert of Judah in the Negev near Arad. Then the men of Judah went with the Simeonites, their brothers, and attacked the Canaanites living in Zephath, and they totally destroyed the city. Therefore, it was called Hormah. The men of Judah also took Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron, each city with its territory. So Judah is just, they're following God's instruction. They're walking in and doing it. And then verse 19 hits. The Lord was with the men of Judah. They took possession of the hill country, but they were unable to drive the people from the plains because they had iron chariots. They had iron chariots? Is that all it takes? Yeah, these aren't cars. They've actually done studies on, like, what does it mean to have an iron chariot? It's not a chariot fully made of iron because no horse could pull it. And it wasn't the wheel. They thought maybe it was the wheels are iron, but then it makes for a really horrible ride. It wouldn't be iron plated because the structure of the wood would still be not strong enough to hold the iron plate. What is an iron chariot? They've done tons of studies. I've read all of these. It was fascinating. What they believe it is they attached scythes and swords and knives to the sides and to the wheels. It's a Batmobile. Because what would happen if there's a chariot, like you got to, Tom, you got to take out a charioteer. What do you got to do, right? You're like, well, I'm going to grab my sword. I'm going to run up to and stab him. Well, what happens if there's swords sticking out the sides and the wheels as they're spinning, right? You don't even need to do anything. You could do drive-by slicing. It's just, shoo, you mow through huge groups of people all because you have these swords, especially with the wheels. It would just cut through these people. What was that? Like Ben-Hur, yeah. Yeah. It's a fascinating thing, and it was this incredible engineering feat. And what they did was they looked at the iron chariots and they're like, no. Were the iron chariots too much for the people? I think the iron chariots were too much because were the Israelite people, were they warriors? No, they were farmers and ex-slaves, right? They, you know, they could till the land really well, but they weren't trained in combat. Could the Israelites have taken them with God on their side? Yeah, the equation always changes whenever you got God on you. If you got God on your side, it doesn't matter if they've got iron chariots or advanced weaponry. But this is the excuse that's given by the Israelites. Like, oh, the iron chariots. Do we have to take the whole land? This area right down there, and that looks pretty. And they got the iron chariots. We got most of it, right? It's close enough. Close enough. No? Close enough work with God? Partially following God's commands? Does that usually work? What about if you partially washed your dishes? Wouldn't that be gross? Yes, Josh? Yeah, I would do that. Until the time you grab a glass and you're pouring milk and all the crusty milk things float to the top and you're like, extra protein. You would drink it, wouldn't you, Josh? No, I wouldn't, he says. I don't know. Partially, when you only partially do something, it ends up usually turning out bad. Life is not horseshoes and hand grenades. It's not about close enough. Partially following God's commands often leads to disastrous results. They were strong enough. Do we ever think that it's too hard to do things in life, especially with religious stuff? Yeah, I that's too hard. I can't forgive that person. They destroyed me. I can't. I hear people say that, right? Don't you? I can't forgive them. What they're saying is it's too difficult. That is so advanced. There is no way I can be able to do that. I cannot live a generous life. I need to focus on myself, not other people around me. I know there's poor people around. I know there's people that are in need. But you know what? I got to think about myself. It's just too hard. I cannot pull it off. The future looks so dark. If I try and do it that way, I need to make sure and take care of myself. I hear this excuse all the time, a lot of religious things. Don't get me wrong, I thought the excuse was kind of a great excuse from the Israelite point of view. They got iron chariots, but they forget they also have God. If you have God, then these great things start happening. But they didn't. They saw the iron chariots, and they freaked out. I wonder if it's going to turn bad for them later on. Verse 20, as Moses had promised, Hebron was given to Caleb, who drove from it the three sons of Anak. They believe that's Goliath's family. The Benjamites, however, failed to dislodge the Jebusites who were living in Jerusalem. To this day, the Jebusites live there with the Benjamites. Now the house of Joseph attacked Bethel, and the Lord was with them when they sent men to spy out Bethel, formerly called Luz, which means light. the spies saw a man coming out of the city, and they said to him, show us how to get into the city, and we will see that you are treated well. So he showed them, and they put the city to the sword, but spared the man and his whole family. Are they following God's instructions? No, only partially. They're like, hey, let's be nice to them. Look what happened. He then went to the city of the Hittites, where he built a city and called it Luz, which is its name to this day. They didn't destroy it. They just moved it. Like a Catholic priest scandal, they didn't handle the problem. They shuffled it down the road. You ever do that? I'd really like to take care of this, but you know what? I can't. I don't have time. So instead of actually solving the issue, you just say, well, we'll leave it later. And Luz doesn't actually get conquered. It just gets moved. Oh, man. Verse 27. You're going to love this. But Manasseh did not drive out the people of Bethshan or Tanakh or Dor or Ibleam or Megiddo and their surrounding settlements. For the Canaanites were determined to live in that land. Oh, really? The Canaanites were determined to live in the land. Is that really all it takes to stop godly progress? Sadly, yeah, all it takes is for something to be too difficult, take too much energy and effort. I love it. They're like, oh, we can't drive these people out. And it actually doesn't say that they couldn't. What does it say? They just did not. It actually implies a choice. They're like, they sure are determined to live in that land. And you're not? Why are you? What did God say? Take the land. But there's people, they look like they want to stay. I don't care. Get them out. Over like this determination, we do the same thing. Prayer is so hard. Because, I know, I feel the same thing. You start to pray, right? And what do? Your mind starts going everywhere else. How much energy does it take to actually pray for longer than 5 minutes? It takes a lot of energy, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, some people, like a muscle, build it up so that they can do it and they can survive longer than 5 minutes, but that's tough. You sit there like, dear Lord, be with my Aunt Kathy. She's got cancer. Heal her. What am I doing for dinner tonight? Heal her. And she's sick. Oh, wait, you already knew that, God. American Idol's on tonight. Wonder who's going to. Oh, no, can't Kathy. It takes a lot of energy and effort. People are like, it's too hard. It takes too much effort. I can't go to church every Sunday. Are you kidding me? Sunday. I finally have the weekend free. And that pastor talks so long. I don't want to go there. Right? It's so hard. Are things, if everything was easy, everyone would do it. In spiritual life, things that are difficult often yield tremendous results because we fully follow them, but it actually takes effort. And that's what I underlined it and I just put a question mark. Like, I don't get this. They're determined to live. We're determined to live here. Well, okay, you can have the land then. You see God saying, are you not determined? Come on. But we say we're lazy. Obedience is always a choice. Because I can tell you, I come up with lots of excuses. And I frequently do. Because things are too hard. Maybe the challenge is too difficult, or maybe it just takes too much energy and effort. Alex? Yeah, everything revolves around God saying, I love you so much, your eternal destination is so important to me that if you hang around these people too long and you don't get rid of them, you will end up no longer believing in me. And then you will be lost forever in hell. That is never God's desire, ever, ever. Yeah, and he'll say that again in chapter 2 as well. Things are going downhill. And then, here we go. This will go fast, I promise. Verse 20, if you want to, I did this. I underlined every single time. Nor did Ephraim, drive out the Canaanites living in Gezer, but the Canaanites continued to live there among them. Neither did Zebulun drive out the Canaanites living in Kitron or Nahalol, who remained among them, but they did subject them to forced labor. Nor did Asher drive out those living in Aco and Sidon or Alab or Akzib or Helba or Aphek or Rehob. And because of the people of Asher lived among the Canaanites inhabitants of the day, neither did Naphtali drive out those living in Beth Shemesh or Beth Anath. But the Naphtalites too lived among the Canaanites inhabitants of the land, and those living in Beth Shemesh and Beth Anath became forced laborers for them. The Amorites, then, and then the last one. So we just went through all this, and what is the general idea? They just didn't do it. Have you ever done that with your kids? Kid makes a stupid choice, and you're like, why did you do that? What is your excuse?
I don't know.
We don't even have, there's not even an excuse. This was, that, you know, again, it baffles me. We're reading through all this, and every single one of the tribes, like, God said to take it over completely, and we didn't. And then Dan. Oh, Dan. Dan. 34, the Amorites confined the Danites to the hill country. It doesn't even sound like the Danites did anything. They're like walking in, they're like, excuse me, this is our place. They're like, you, get up in the hills now.
Okay.
And they leave. The Amorites confined the Danites instead of the Danites confining the Amorites and kicking them out. They didn't even do anything. They didn't even try. Do this. I don't even want to try. Oh, my gosh. The Amorites confined the Danites to the whole country,
not allowing them to come down to the plain. I could just see it. They're like coming down. They're like,
no, back to the whole country with you.
Run.
It cracks me up, but I'm saddened. And the Amorites were determined. The Amorites were determined. Isn't that great? Danites had no determination whatsoever. Oh, my gosh. They were determined to hold out in Mount Harris, Ajalon, and Shabim. When the power of the house of Joseph increased, they too were pressed into forced labor. The boundary of the Amorites was from Scorpion past the Seal and beyond. So what is chapter 1 all about? It's all about this slow decline that they didn't kick out the people. They only partially followed God's instructions. And because they only partially followed God's instructions, bad things started to happen. Yeah, George? Yes, that'll be my point in about 3 minutes. Yes, very good. Yeah, no. That's good. But you picked up, because that's actually in the first part of the chapter when everything was going good. What did they do? They did two important things. One of them, that we'll get to that. Yes, Jeff. No, that wasn't Dan. That was, I believe that was Manasseh. They were crossing into the Jordan, and they're like, oh, we really like this part in the east. Can we have this instead? But Dan, like, when you read Dan all through Judges and 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st Kings, they're a mess. They're a tragic mess. They are not even close. What does this all really mean? Like, when I started to think, how does it really apply to us? This is really important because this is really a symbol or picture of our very own lives. I believe most of you here, I'm hoping all of you here, have a faith relationship with Jesus. Does that mean, has sin, death, and the power of the devil been conquered in your life? Yes. Do you still have battles today? This is the thing. They came in Joshua. They totally subdued these large areas of land, but there were these pockets of resistance that could not come under the control because they just didn't drive it out. And this is us as well. We're like, oh, we're saved, so I don't really want to do this or that. I don't really want to follow God's instructions here or here. It's too much work. It's too hard. It's too difficult. I don't even have an excuse. We let those other things go, and we think maybe that's close enough. And God says, no. There are areas in your life that are not under the control of God, right? I know it to be true because it's true for me. If it's true for me, it has to be true for you. I've talked to people. They struggle with stuff. They're like, I have struggles with this. Yeah, you can be saved, have kind of the land conquered in a general sense with these pockets of resistance that keep, and God says drive it out, because if you allow that area to grow and fester like a cancer, it will eventually take over your whole life and absolutely ruin it. Is this not true? If you let sin continually go unchecked, eventually your life goes downhill. So what do we do? Go back to chapter 1, verse 1. We're going to get a George here, but we got to do the first one first. The very first thing they did is, what did they do? They prayed. They asked God. Where was God mentioned after that? Did it ever mention them saying, okay, God, now what do we do? Do you ever pray about
the small pockets of resistance you have in your life? Maybe you're too ashamed. Newsflash, God already knows it. You have all the excuses. What if you actually tried praying the excuses? What would God say to that? God, I really have a hard time forgiving this person. And I'm going to need your help. Do you think God's going to go, ha! No, you got to do that on your own. Sorry. Or is God going to say, you asked for my help on this. I'm going to come in. I'm going to help you. I'm going to totally transform. I'm going to change your heart so that you can actually forgive these people. Can God change it so that you can love your spouse or love your neighbor or love your boss who is the devil incarnate? Yeah. God can actually change it. What if we just say, Lord, praying is hard. Help me stay focused on you for just even 5 minutes of my time. Help me grow in this area. Do you think God's going to go, no, do it yourself? Over and over again, he says, look, you do this, I'm going to be right there with you the whole time. You fully follow my instructions, you're going to have good things happen. And then, really important, Judah and Simeon, what do? They team up. How often do we do it alone? Right? You got something bad going on in your life, and you get the lie in there, I'm the only person struggling with this. I've talked about this before, right? You look around the people, right? Look around. See all the perfect people here, right? And you're like, man, those people got their lives together. They do not have their lives together. Their lives are a mess. And that's okay. If we actually just simply go and say, I need some help, what would actually happen if we actually started doing this? Maybe you have a problem with cussing, right? Most of the time, your words are wholesome and generally good for, you know, consumption by your grandmother. But every now and then, you just kind of let it loose. What happens if you found some help in that? Heather used to do this. It was brilliant. Doesn't do it anymore. We don't hear it that much anymore. I don't know if I should say that. I'm just going to skip that. But you need to seek help from one. Yeah. Oh, no. Heather did not used to do it where Heather's.
Please edit that out of the. Yeah.
No. Heather used to help people not cuss. Yes, my apologies, I misspoke. Heather used to cuss like a sailor. You should hear when she's. Oh, man, that didn't work the way. Can you get help if you have this issue? Can you seek help and get strength from other people? Yeah. What if you, yeah. An ugly green pig, okay. Jody has an ugly green pig on her desk. I'm sorry. There. Oh, if you swear, put 50 cents in it. Yeah. I think the financial incentive sometimes is good. Yeah, they're like, I'm going to cuss for the next 3 days, so here you go. There's my $5. Yeah. Yeah, you can get some help on this. What if you struggle with other issues? What if you struggle with sexting? Speaking of teenagers, what if you are tempted to ask for photos or you are not strong enough and secure in your own self-esteem that you actually offer up photos? The other areas of your life is great. The rest of your phone, texting, all good. It's one area, not so good. What happens if you shared that and you sought help and you were able to get someone else to help you with that? Could that radically change? We try to go it alone way too often in life. And I know it's embarrassing. No one wants to talk about the fact that we're Danites. We look down like, I don't think I can do that. Or we're like Manasseh, I can't do that. Oh, their chariots are too strong, or it's just too much work. Sometimes there comes a point where we say we need the help from one another. And didn't Jesus do this? Did Jesus pray when things were difficult? Did Jesus seek the help of 12 people? Yeah. Over and over and over again, we see Jesus doing these same thing. Yeah, three to play, yeah. Yeah, granted, and they didn't do a very good job. I mean, could Jesus have done the whole thing all by himself? Yeah, theoretically, he could, but he didn't. He chose to be in communion and conversation, fellowship with one another. This is important. Isn't it great that Jesus didn't partially follow God's instructions? Yeah, what would happen if he's like, putting the nails, and he's like, oh, no,
That hurts. No, I'm out. No, I'm out. I'm done. I'm sorry. We're done. This is bad. It hurts. No. What would that mean for you and me? Yeah. We're done. We're out. We're in hell. We're going to be punished for our own sins. But Jesus fully followed God's instructions, and because of that, we're saved. Now, same lesson for us. Partially follow God's instructions tends to have bad results, like this cake. Our lives are a mess, goopy, disgusting, and gross. But if we fully follow God's instructions, Joshua, what did you put in this cake? And some vegetable oil. Very good. Did you measure it out? Did you bake it for the allotted time? Follow God's instructions. That's good. Things can go well. This cake will be outside to eat. Let's pray. Lord, we're sorry for times that we have not followed your instructions. We have so many excuses. It's incredible. We can say all sorts of things, but it's just not right. Instead, we should be fully following your instructions. Because when we do that, things tend to go better for us. We know that the book of Judges was written so that we might have an example, maybe to follow or maybe even not to follow. But we know that we can learn a lot from it. I pray that you've challenged us, that our lives would not be undercooked, that our lives would not be measured incorrectly, that our lives would have proper ingredients, that we would follow what you say. It would go well with us in life, in our spiritual life. We thank you that Jesus Christ did that completely for us, because without it, we would have no salvation. But we are grateful for all that he has done, continues to do in our life. We thank you and praise you in Jesus' name. Amen.